It's October 20th, 2008, at 1:09 p.m. We have some different things today. We're going to have a report from the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services, the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children, and then a work discussion on legislative concepts. And what I plan to do with that is we're going to introduce those en masse, get those in the process. But Mac has pointed out there was a couple errors, at least
in my summary.
Some of which has to do with typing rather than actual errors, but we'll be sure they get that clarified before we set those House bills in, the House season. So can have Paul Evans, the chair of the task force, come up and make a report on that.
Well, this must be yours.
Yeah, they are.
Oh, okay.
Let's
see.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you.
Given the length of items on the agenda, I'll try to keep the remarks fairly brief, but I do want to give you an overall picture of where the task force has been and what we believe will be the draft recommendations. So here we go. First of all, when you're talking about veterans issues in Oregon, the veterans landscape, as you all know, is complex. We have about 350,000 veterans in Oregon. About 80,000 veterans are enrolled in some kind of assistance, which leaves about 270,000 veterans not enrolled in some kind of assistance. We have about $1.12 billion in assistance, federal assistance, coming into the state. And to date, we've had about 7,000 National Guard mobilizations, with about 3,000 mobilizations expected for next year for service in OIF, and about 4,000 reserve component mobilizations throughout Oregon. That number's a little more squishy to get a hold of because General Loop and some of the reservists are not exactly sure who's where in the current reserve structure. And then on top of all that, we have an unknown number of formerly active duty folks that have come back to Oregon. We know they're here when they tell us they're here, but sometimes they don't share that, so we just don't know sometimes what we don't know. As you recall, the task force was put together, signed into existence in March under Executive Order 0808. It was charged with the responsibility of putting together a review of current local, state, and federal policies having to do with veterans and veteran services. We spent about 2 months going through the main major themes, education, employment, healthcare, housing, retirement. And then we spent about 2 months going around the state. We toured 24 different communities, and in each tour or each site, we had opportunities to look at facilities that are for veterans. We met with local leaders, and we held open to the public town hall forums. Overall, the process has been a very enriching process. We think we've learned a lot, and the hard part, of course, is prioritizing the major themes that we think we can take action on. The issues I'm going to talk about today, understanding that we're going to try to phase in over a 2 to 4 year time frame, especially given the context of the current budget, we're going to make recommendations to the governor. The governor will then take what recommendations he believes are the priority for this session, and we'll continue to try to march the ball down the field in future sessions. Also, some of the recommendations here are really for federal action, and in that particular case, we're asking the legislature to consider a memorial and conversation through the National Conference of State Legislators and other groups to try to move some of these issues in the U.S. Congress. So, here we go. In terms of education, the task force is looking to recommend that we field veteran service officers at public universities and community colleges. It's felt that a VSO on campus can actually help facilitate both the new GI Bill as well as getting folks that are students into the programs that they may be entitled to. We did a small pilot program at PSU that was very successful, and we believe the more we can have a one-stop shopping center for veterans will not only provide better success for veterans going to school, but also provide the veterans and their families with some of the services that they may not even know that they're entitled to. We're also looking at a waiver, and I want to be very specific about this one. a waiver of out-of-state tuition for veterans seeking access. The new GI Bill may very well take care of the costs associated with out-of-state tuition. But under the old Montgomery GI Bill, veterans that come from another state are not automatically given in-state status for tuition. Other states, Ohio being an example, have said that if you're a veteran, you're a citizen of Ohio. We'd like to take down the barriers to make sure that if veterans from across the country would like to come to school in Oregon, we'd like to have that open door. That's especially important for National Guard and reservists. We also are looking at some pilot programs in terms of child care and housing, as well as transition programs at Eastern Oregon University in Portland State. These are not going to be legislative initiatives this time, but rather a particular pilot program that we're going to try to use existing resources to try to put into action. Draft recommendations having to do with employment. We believe that it's important that the Congress looks to increase the DFOP and leaver staffing throughout Oregon, that the current staff levels are not sufficient, and that veterans looking for employment, especially in a time of economic downturn, is even more important than ever. We also believe that we need to develop and fund a public information campaign supporting the Oregon Hire Vets Initiative. The Oregon Hire Vets Initiative is working well, but not everybody knows about it, and a lot of employers still don't know about it. We're looking at development and funding of a state recognition program for employers that hire and retain veterans. This one's not a very high-cost item, but rather we want to make sure that the folks that are out there doing the right things for the veterans get recognition that they're doing the right things for the veterans. We're also looking at a state facilitation of a private sector veterans employment compact. This is a little more complicated, but the private sector in discussions about tax credits actually pushed back a little bit, and I have to tell you, it was one of the surprises of the process. On the table was a discussion about what kinds of tax credits might be helpful for employers that are trying to do the right thing. And to a person, the employers around the table said that there should not be a tax credit, that businesses should be doing this as a matter of the right kind of approach, and that one particular business, the Platt, Harvey Platt, said that he would actually stand up and volunteer to help put together a compact of employers so that if, when a soldier comes back, there isn't a job for him because of economic uncertainty, that one of the other employers in the compact will help hire him on. It's an interesting approach. We want to try to pursue that and provide whatever support necessary. But the interesting thing is it's the Chamber and the Oregon Business Alliance and private sector really want to take the ball on this one and move it forward. Draft recommendations having to do with health care. This really is much more of a federal issue than any other item on the table. We believe, the task force believes, that the legislature should strongly urge the Congress to rethink the categories of funding and to fully fund categories 1 through 8 in the Veterans Health Administration. That ultimately, especially in Oregon, where we have a number of veterans living in remote and rural areas, that if it was a simpler system that provided access for all veterans that had a DD Form 214, that would actually provide better care and in some cases reduce cost in terms of trying to decide whether or not a person is entitled, simply just providing the care. It's a big issue. It's a big push. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs actually has the authority to do this. It's just a matter of the funding that goes with it, and we think that that's an important and essential piece. We also believe that the Veterans Health Administration should look at expanding and simplifying the fee basis system, because some places around the state, Gold Beach, for example, are so far and remote that there are inherent risks for the travel back and forth for basic medical care. We are going to encourage the legislature to review and tweak the TRICARE legislation that you passed, TRICARE incentives that you passed last session. We recognized as the implementation phase came about that there was some language that was getting in the way of actually providing the medical providers with the incentive that we had hoped they would get. So there will be a legislative concept for that one that we think is a very minor fix. We're also going to encourage the Congress to increase the reimbursement rate for TRICARE, because ultimately that is the heart of the issue. And then the final thing under health care is trying to develop increased flexibility in terms of partnerships for remote and rural areas. There may be some public-private partnerships that could make sense in some areas, especially in the remote and rural areas, that may not pencil out in more urban areas. Draft recommendations for housing. Task force believes that greater flexibility in VA housing and funding is essential, that the homeless to work programs, especially programs such as COVO in Bend, Central Oregon Veterans Outreach, that have literally transformed people's lives and given them a way to maximize the available assets, the available help from the Veterans Administration to get back into society, cannot be underemphasized or cannot be overemphasized. And that we also need to look at student housing and some flexibility in terms of new aging housing models, that there may be some partnerships out there. Task force will also recommend a legislative concept for a state constitutional referral, deleting the 30-year cap on ODVA home loan program. We recognize that people are living longer, and that's a particular kind of benefit that should be allowed for beyond the 30-year cap. To help facilitate that, we'll also be asking Congress for federal authorization for state programs to mirror federal programs to make sure that we can actually do what we'd like to try to do. And then the final piece under housing goes back to trying to develop and fund partnership incentives for local housing options, that it, when a local community gets involved, it really can make the difference. Draft recommendations, there was a category that we've actually, there's two categories that we set up after the study began that we didn't realize would be a big enough issue to merit its own, but in fact it did. Families. Draft recommendations for veteran families. To date, because again, the military had been, up until recent times, mostly a male-dominated, male service organization, there are fundamental transformations going on. For example, about 7,500 women served during the Vietnam era. We have about 185,000 women that have served in Iraq and Afghanistan to date, and there will be more. This trend will not go back. It will increase and continue. So we need to rethink some of the things that we used to think we knew. So here are the recommendations. Number one, expansion of eligibility programs and expenditures for whole family initiatives. This is especially important when single mothers that are veterans require care and no federal dollars can be spent on anybody but the veteran. So we actually, there's some weird incentives there for the mother to be separated from the child when she's trying to get care. That needs to be changed at the federal level. We need some increases in the ODVA and Oregon Military Department emergency relief funds. I know funds are tight going into the session, but if we can provide that rent check that will prevent someone from losing their job, that will prevent them from getting on to other services, that initial help and that flexibility we think is crucial. The development and funding of the feasibility for veterans courts, which I know this committee has already begun work on, we think that certainly merits further study, and that we've actually found some specific cases where had there been a veterans court, someone would have probably ended up a little better off. And then the last piece under families is the establishment of an Oregon Military Families Appreciation Day. That sometimes, especially in Oregon, where we don't have any active duty bases, but we have Guard and Reserve, sometimes it's important for society as a whole to recognize that there are a lot of military families that are going through a very unique experience. Draft recommendations for reintegration. I want to take a real quick moment and say thank you for all that you have done in supporting Oregon's reintegration initiatives. This may already be known, but quite frankly, Oregon sets the pace with this. Other states borrow and steal and never really give credit for the ideas that they've taken from Oregon, but Oregon is, in fact, setting the pace for reintegration. And one of the things about a task force is that everybody assumes we're going in to try to find all the things that were bad. First of all, a task force really learned that Oregon is leading the way on a lot of veterans issues, and most specifically on reintegration, that we are far ahead. Now, having said that, there's some more things that we can do. First, the development of regional mini-summit structures. There'll be more on this in the future. We have a legislative concept for you to look at. But basically the idea of trying to provide a structure with very low cost. The current summit that's put on is very low cost. But to try to tailor and regionalize some of the networks. There are across the state, such as the Eugene Vet Network and the Portland Vet Network, there are places that information flow is very, very effective. There are a lot of areas around the state that information flow is not so effective. So what we would like to try to do is take what's working from the Oregon Summit structure and what's working from some of the vet networks that are out there and provide a structure across Oregon that's kind of one notch down that we can make sure the same information is going out to everybody. And again, there'll be more information on that in the future. We believe that increased staffing for the reintegration, it's going to be called now the Yellow Ribbon Program because of some congressional changes, but we believe that increased staffing is going to be needed for the upcoming return of the 3,000 folks that are going to OIF. I want to emphasize that again. This is, for many of them, not their first deployment. It's their second deployment. And that's really where most of our concern is. We believe that most folks can get through one deployment, but it's that second and third deployment where so much uncertainty has happened on the family, so much uncertainty has happened with the job, that we need to have all the oars in the water pushing the same way. We also believe that the 90-day soft landing proposal that the legislature passed through Memorial last year, or last session, is again a program that merits support and assistance. The good news on this is that Senator Wyden has volunteered to, at least last week, he stepped forward and said he was going to carry that that issue. It's gaining favor across the country, recognizing that you need a little bit of space and time for the soldier to go from the battlefield to Main Street. And any support through Memorial and through the networks that you have on this 90-day soft landing proposal, we believe will make a tremendous difference. On draft recommendations for retirement, there's three issues that we wanted to bring forward. The first is a development and funding of a permanent maintenance budget for the Oregon Veterans Home in the Dalles. We also want to look at expansion of in-residence care for aging veterans, and that also includes the third piece, creative partnerships. For a long time, we've been thinking about building new veterans homes. There may be some opportunities where instead of building new space, we may be able to lease space in a partnership with some existing entities. So we're going to try to do some more exploration on that and come forward with some proposals. Draft recommendation on transportation. Basically, we recognized, especially in the remote and rural areas of Oregon, transportation is a huge deal. We, bottom line, believe that two things should happen. Number one, that the VA at the federal level needs to restructure how it runs transportation to and from medical care. We also believe that in the short term, there should be a task force. We're thinking work group, but I guess the new fancy word is task force for everything. So a task force to study veterans, transportation, and potential partnerships. And the reason I want to emphasize that is this. Throughout Oregon, there's a number of local transit districts, and we just did not have the time with this particular task force to get into the intricacies of how different partnerships could be put together to do that. But we believe that in some areas, it may make sense to use existing structures. In other areas, there just may not be enough capacity to meet the needs of the veterans. So we're smart enough to know what we don't know, and we know that on this transportation issue that it is such a big issue across the state that it warrants further study. Draft recommendations for women veterans. This is one of the issues that one of the two areas that we did not at the beginning understand the size and scope of the challenges. Right now in Oregon, or actually right now in the country, west of the Mississippi, there are about 12 beds for in-residence care for women veterans. 12. 185,000 women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. We recognize that the country has not yet, and the military, and even the veteran structure, has not yet begun the same transformation that society has. And some of the proposals that we have for consideration are a little bit out of left field, but here we go. The first is an establishment of a work group task force looking at the feasibility of transitioning the Eastern Oregon Training Center and another facility, probably in Salem, into a network of in-residence care for women and veterans that includes support for families while the women veterans are in care. It's an interesting concept. We believe there's physical structures out there. It would be ideally paid for through the federal government. There are funds now becoming available, but there's no real delivery systems, and that's what we need to be looking at. We also need to look at development and funding of a military sexual trauma public information campaign. This issue has become much more, I should say the public has become much more aware of this issue. It's existed for some time, but it's one of those things that we need to make sure that people understand the impact of that trauma. And then the third piece is expansion of mental health care access for women veterans living in remote and rural areas. We don't exactly know how to do that, but we recognize that that is a significant need that currently is not being met. There are some future things, future study issues that I want to bring up, and then I'll try to bring this portion down to close and try to respond to questions. But there are There are five major things that are on our mind looking out toward the future, recognizing that there are some things that we think we know. First thing that we think we know, the National Guard and Reserve will never go back to being a strategic reserve. We will be operational for the foreseeable future. The second is that we need to find structures that can help sustain the force, the reserves, and the Guard during these times. That you still need the Guard to be able to answer during a storm, and you still need the Guard and Reserve to be able to help when no one else can. So here are some impacts for the back of your mind. The first, there needs to be more study on the impact of multiple deployments and technological advances on veterans and families. We now have a situation where folks go two and three times overseas for a year at a time, and where while they're gone, because of the internet and cell phones, they are still connected to the family experience and yet unconnected to the family experience. It is creating a very weird situation where a fella or a female can be going out on patrol and come back and find out what their child did or didn't do in school that day. It is a very interesting experience, and we're not sure what that impact is going to be. The second, the impact of declining military experience upon public policy and long-term care. That fewer and fewer people in this particular war, fewer Americans have served in this particular war. And one of the issues is, because of that lack of experience, what does that suggest for long-term care? Third impact, the ongoing gender transformation of military services upon health care access. The VA does not have enough female doctors to help treat the number of patients that they could have. We really do need to rethink how services are being delivered, and with an eye toward providing women and men the kind of care they need, what standards need to be in place. We also look at the impact of the TRICARE structure and ultimately look at TRICARE and push the Congress to use TRICARE as a way of making sure that the families and the soldiers and the airmen are ready, but in a preventative way. We're still trying to catch up. TRICARE's worked very hard on that, but we believe the reimbursement rates has really kind of kept TRICARE from doing what it could be doing. And then the fifth issue is the impact of VA prescription services for aging veterans. Really, in medical care, especially among aging Americans, prescription drugs are a huge cost. There might be a way, if we can't fully fund categories 1 through 8 for all care, maybe at least we can provide prescription care for some of the veterans. And that's an impact that as technology provides more medicine, but those medicines cost more, that needs to be considered. Overall, looking at it from where we are, we believe there are five game changers, and this is the priority that we're going to put forward. The first is full funding for VHA categories 1 through 8. The second is the restructure of VHA transportation system. The third, number three, is the 90-day soft landing for National Guard and Reservists. Number four is the restructure and expansion of VA housing efforts. And the fifth is the restoration of the DVOP and LEVR staffing. If we can get those five things, we can have a much better opportunity to meet the needs of the veterans both now and in the future. So that's the 30,000-foot view of the recommendations. Again, budgets will clearly get in the way of some of these things, and the governor will look at this, and we will support the governor's package. But I told you as we started this task force some time ago that we try to keep you in the loop on what we think we know.
Thank you.
There's a lot here, Paul, and there's a lot of really good stuff here. Just a couple things. There's a lot of things that I want to talk to you about, but I'm narrowed it down here. The tax credit for hiring vets, I'm all for people being altruistic, and I'm glad these businesses are stepping up. I didn't really hear an explanation about why the businesses didn't want to go with the tax credit. And then in-state tuition rates for veterans, if the veteran chooses to come to Oregon or South Dakota or Florida, you know, a lot of federal money is contingent on state policies. Well, in the federal packet of requests there, why doesn't the federal government just say, if you want money, provide veterans with in-state residents' tuition rates. So that way every state's on board, which they should be on board. Not that I wouldn't support this in Oregon, but, and then, you know, then you ended with the budget thing. Look, I'm going to jump to the federal. If the federal government is going to always have these men and women in operational, you know, status, which I understand that clearly, then clearly they need to step up and help us out. But in the state, and I harped on it in Chair Boone's committee, and I'm going to harp out on this one, and everywhere I go, Yeah, budgets are going to be tight next year. Guess what? This state is dripping in money. It's growing, burning, and rotting in the forests. It's running down the river unused, sitting in arable land that isn't being irrigated because we can't, God forbid, we care, pull a drop of water out of the Columbia. And it's sitting right across an artificial, politically, arbitrarily designated line where you can't build industry. That's the problem with Oregon. We got all kinds of money. We just lack the political will to go get it. So the second part there was my opinion, but I'm interested in the credit and the residents, the federal policy. It's just like transportation dollars. You want federal money, you allow veterans to attend your colleges at in-state tuition rates.
But Chair Barker, Representative Schaffler, I'm a coward next to you on some of that opinion that you gave, but I understand where you're coming from. And my first job when I got out of the Air Force was pulling green chain, so I understand what you're saying. Let me start with something I forgot to mention, and then I'll go to the tax rate. One thing that we recognize throughout the process, and we don't think it's going to be a legislative concept because we think this can be done through administrative rule, but one of the things we recognized is that most state agencies, most local agencies, never ask whether someone's a veteran or not. And there's a lot of dollars being left on the table simply because people don't know what they don't know. So in addition to all these big costly things we're talking about, one of the things that's really not costly at all, because people can weave it into their forms whenever they update their forms, is asking the question and then providing contact information and getting them enrolled. And you know, most veterans may not be getting a whole lot, but some will. And that's all good. Now, having to do with the tax incentive for businesses, I got to tell you, I was surprised when we got that, because we had an internal debate looking at tax incentives really through two different lenses. One was getting vets hired. That's important. That's essential. And that's really been the model for Senate Bill 822 last time, as far as making sure there's preferences and things like that. My concern is not so much the hiring. My concern is the retention piece. I want to make sure the businesses can get whatever help and support they might need to make sure that vet has a job for 5 years or 6 years or 7 years. So we went into that discussion saying, all right, well, what kinds of incentives? Do you want a per veteran piece of a tax credit? Do you want thresholds? Do you want particular kinds of industry that are more likely to have veterans than not? And frankly, I was surprised by their answers. Having said that, I think that if it's the answer that I got from them was that the tax incentives would be so small in relation to their overall tax contributions that they just didn't think that that would help move public policy. From a personal standpoint, I'm up for talking about that. I think that long term, as we have a lot of deployments, that if we can't get tax incentives, then working with the federal government to explore what we call Vets Helping Vets, which would be looking at folks that are unemployed or even folks that are VA interns, and trying to find a way to match those folks to short-term gap fillers for businesses that have mobilizations. Some way of at least providing the business, if not a benefit for helping, then at least make sure that they're not losing something when someone gets deployed. But their answer was that they felt that it was a patriotic thing, that if you're an Oregon business, you get the benefit of it, you should stand up and help. And like I said, I was surprised. But their argument was that there just wasn't a big enough incentive. As far as linking state residency to federal transportation dollars,
or any dollars.
Tomorrow, we're meeting with the congressional delegation. That's another piece of what we're trying to do, so that there's transparency throughout. We're meeting with the congressional delegation about these, and I'll certainly bring forward your idea of linking it to state residency.
I just have a couple of comments, too. This is a great report. I really thank you for all the work that you put into getting that out. I had a friend who recently had a hearing loss. He went into a doctor, and regular doctor, no military claim, and they asked him what he'd done for a living because he had this thing, and his job wouldn't have caused that. And they said, well, what did you do? Have you ever done anything else? And he said, well, he was in the Air Force. He was a mechanic working around jet engines. They said, that's your hearing loss right there. They said and told him to go up to the VA. The VA got him in right away, got him hearing aids, got him fixed up, got him the veterans, you know, some veterans benefits that he didn't have any clue about. So they did a real good job on that. And he's a Vietnam era veteran. So that was really good. And I talked to some veterans in my community, and they're concerned about some of the priority. And I told them, well, we'll have a time to look at that. They wanted some widows and orphans education benefits and stuff to be a little farther ahead. And I said, well, you know, you want to know, did he need to come down here today to try to raise all the issues? And I said, no, he didn't. But we would certainly be looking at those down the road. So, again, thank you very much.
Chair Barker, if I could, a couple minutes, there's one other issue I wanted to mention briefly. And it's not so much having to do with task force, but I think it does result from the conversations that we had throughout the task force. First is the Oregon War Veterans Association and Department of Revenue, Military Department, and a number of us, including Senator Walker, Senator Boquist, were involved in rethinking current language and rethinking current interpretation having to do with a tax deduction that was passed by the legislature in 2007. There's going to be a temporary rule put into place, we believe, around 1 November that will require some legislation in the beginning of the session that basically will support the legislative intent of that action. And it's one of those things where, because of, I think, the conversations that we've had all year long about how can we work together to solve some of these problems, I think everybody's going to walk away with a win. And I think to the National Guard and Reservists, they'll be able to fully deduct $6,000 a year that's associated with their active service, are well served by all the advocates that were involved in that process. And I just want to personally thank Debbie Buchanan and Director Harshenko for getting involved in the process. I also want to thank Jim Willis, Paula Brown, and Tom Mann from Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, who have been truly remarkable in making this whole process a reality. So thank you for the opportunity to come forward. And
I'll say one more thing, too, that you reminded me of. There was a constituent of Carolyn Tomei's contacted her about the 30-year home loans. He's saying, I'm older now, I'm solid financially, or he was before last week, I don't know if he still is. And he wanted to buy a downsized home, and he thought he should get a veteran's loan. And of course, I said, well, we contacted and talked to Tom Mann, and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs got back so quick with all the information and explained. He was happy with the explanation, although it didn't get the results yet. But I just want to say what a great job they are doing. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has done that's just a small example of the good work they do. And that was greatly appreciated by the veteran and by, I know, Representative Tomei and myself.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to testify briefly on this matter? Okay, thank you. Next item on the agenda is the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children. Roxanne Susi.
Mr. Chair and Committee, thank you for inviting me to speak with you this afternoon. My name is Mark Sansusi, and I am a retired Air Force guy, and I am the regional liaison for military families for the Northwest, including Oregon. I work for the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Military Community and Family Policy on military quality of life issues for military families. I'm here today to introduce to you the Department of Defense's attempt to help transitioning military school children who move from state to state and school district to school district based on the movements when their parents are serving our nation. I'm here, and by the way, that's K through 12. Given time constraints, I'd like to emphasize a few key points. The Department of Defense considers military school children in transition issues as one of our top 10 key issues in quality of life for our military families. The compact, and you have a CSG resource kit in front of you, which is all-inclusive, so I'm just trying to, for time, hit the main points. The compact was drafted by 18 stakeholding organizations, including the National Association of Elementary School Principals, National School Boards Association, the National Parent Teachers Association, the National Education Association, and state departments of education in California, Florida, Maryland, and including state government representation from Nevada, North Carolina, and Alabama. 11 states, since we introduced this in December of 2007 nationally, have enacted this interstate compact, including Arizona, Colorado, Oklahoma, Florida, Connecticut, Missouri, Michigan, Kansas, Kentucky, North Carolina, and Delaware. Task forces are working on it in Washington State, and I happen to be a member of that task force to talk a little bit about that, a little more about that. California, Illinois, and Maryland currently all working on this, studying it for possibly 2009. Because we reached the 10-state threshold, we were seeking 10 states to enact to trigger the Interstate Commission, because 20 states hold the bulk of our military children. Because we reached that 10-state threshold this year to trigger the commission, the first meeting of the 11 voting member states is later this month in Mesa, Arizona, from October 27 to 29, where they will begin the rulemaking process. The compact that you have in front of you, the 30 pages that talk about the policy components, we consider to be the skeleton, and as the commission meets, they will start writing, putting the muscle onto the bone, so to speak. The compact applies to children of active duty and activated Guard and Reserve members. In Oregon, 2007 Defense Management Data Center data shows you have approximately 4,300 active duty spouses and children in your state, and about 25,000 Guard and Reserve members, spouses, and children. Since the compact applies to all active duty and activated Guard reservists at any time, a significant portion of Oregonians would be covered by this compact, and we know that you have units activated right now serving in places like Iraq. Before I basically cover the policy components of the compact, I want to tell you that we know already that many Oregon school districts do a lot of what this compact addresses. The distinction to be made, though, is that the compact is about the sending and the receiving states and school districts. We're just as concerned about a military child who leaves Oregon and moves to Kansas as vice versa. So if a military family moves into Oregon from another compact state, we seek the consistency in applying the components of the compact and the uniformity that it will provide in these areas that I'll talk about, from state to state and school district to school district. More specifically, if a military family of an activated Portland Guard unit moves to Grandma's house in Vancouver, Washington, or Grandma's house in Montana, we seek to have the policy protections in those states too. So being part of the Interstate Commission among member states will provide a level playing field, that's the intent, for those transitioning military kids. Also, the decision to ask states to voluntarily enact this legislation and be part of an interstate commission is in respect for federalism rather than having a federal mandate. We want the states to voluntarily want to do this and enact this legislation to become part of the compact. The complete package you have in front of you, I'll just touch on the policy components. And again, it's seeking uniformity among the states in the areas of enrollment issues like records transfer, immunizations, entrance ages, eligibility issues like extracurricular activities, tuition charges, and rights of non-custodial parents taking care of kids from parents who are deployed. Placement issues like course placement to continue the student's progress in advanced placement or honors programs, special needs programs, and we'd like to give the local education agencies more waiver flexibility in their jurisdictions, granting absences relating to parents' deployment. Graduation issues are also in there, and we want to try and encourage waiving similar coursework completed by students in other states moving into our state, more options on exit exams on what would be accepted, and transfers during the senior year of high school to help the student graduate on time. There are particulars about all of these, but again, I want to stay within the 10 minutes. I'll given. I've been asked about costs, and the CSG resource kit in there talks about a typical interstate commission, and it talks about the number of military school children, and it comes up with a number of a dollar per military kid. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say I know for a fact that it's a dollar per military kid, because the overhead cost of how whatever the interstate commission determines it wants for overhead will factor into a cost, and then the internal cost once a state enacts to have a compact commissioner, meant to be a part-time thing that someone would do to attend the once a year or twice a year interstate commission meetings, those are costs too. I am currently serving on the governor's task force studying the compact in the state of Washington. I would be happy to share whatever information I can with you. Our report to include recommendations is due out on December 1st. I can tell you reliably that Washington's study is the most comprehensive in the nation. It's probably even more comprehensive than the 11 states that went ahead and took that leap and enacted it within this last legislative year. We're looking at fiscal notes, and we're looking at the areas which the bill had established our task force asked us to do. We're looking at what components of the compact are currently being substantially implemented in Washington and which are not, the implications of and the interplay between the compact and applicable federal education law, the implications of and the interplay between the compact and applicable state education law, the legal obligations the compact would impose on the state if it were to be adopted, and we're addressing any provisions within the compact that raise concerns of the task force members, and we will be making recommendations on how to address those concerns in our final report. Again, this is due to back to the governor on December 1st, 2008. We are on target. We're meeting once a month. And we've had 5 months' worth of meetings, and we're getting down to that point where we're now voting. We're working with the Council of State Governments, and we're coordinating and tweaking the language in some areas where we want the language to be more compatible with Washington State without materially changing the intent of the legislation or the compact itself. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I hope you will consider making this compact a legislative issue in the 2009 year, so Oregon can join the enacting states, and as the rulemaking process is just beginning, it would be better to be part of this thing when the rules are just starting to be written here within the next year than being the 50th state, let's say. Finally, as a retired Air Force officer myself, who's moved 12 times in the last 22 years, and like everyone else has, is full of stories about what happened and with those moves. I stand ready to answer any questions you might have. And thank you for the opportunity to introduce this to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for coming, Mark. And my brother-in-law, my sister and brother-in-law, my brother-in-law was in the Coast Guard for 28 years. And they have a strong nuclear family. They have a lot of family support. And he's retired now, but they certainly, like as you just talked about, face a challenge of moving all the time. I guess my question is, and it's kind of, the good chair was talking about a veteran who didn't know he had these benefits and went up to VA and got squared away. And maybe the department could answer this question, but overall, these men and women that are in this position, is there a lot of outreach explaining to them the benefits, the help they can get if there's a challenge of some kind, or information on what can make these transitions easier for them and their kids?
Within the respective services, there are school liaison officer programs. The Army is the leader with the SLO program, it's called. On all the installations, there are people who do outreach to the outlying school districts, and as the incoming members come to Fort Lewis, let's say they have briefings. The school liaison officer program works with the 19 school districts that have kids from Fort Lewis. The Air Force has a similar program, and the Navy is just putting an unveiling one that pretty much models the Army's program. So there is actively that kind of program being worked to help the families. However, with local control, and all states can be different in interpretation of transcripts and graduation requirements and cutoff dates for being in the band and cheerleading. Some of those things are what we're trying to do here. So there is an awareness. The services are trying to help, but we need help with
the respective states to kind of look at this compact so we can have that, what we call, level playing field.
Thank you. I think it's important, too, and you kind of touched on it with the single, or was touched on earlier about single mothers who are called to service. The kid's going to probably go home to grandma, or maybe, but in a different, quite possibly a different place, and so it's important that the kids have the least disruption in the education system as possible. I think this is a great program. And if you get moved to a different base, that's not really a choice. You're going to go in the military. And I personally, one time after I was out of the military, I had a real good job opportunity, and they said, you know, it's great, and it really pays all this money. I'm thinking, man, that sounds great. They said, you'll have to be in D.C. for 2 years. I had little kids. I was not going to go to D.C. for 2 years at that time. That's many years ago. But anyway, I had the choice not to do that. If I'd been in the military, I wouldn't have had the choice. So I think your program has a lot of validity, and I think you'll find broad support here.
And Mr. Chair, that's in the Washington Task Force. We have considered whether we want to enact something that is just military kids or try and look at all kids. And we just voted to keep this within the military population, looking at opportunity to maybe leverage this at a later date for
that's
all children, because there is a difference between a Microsoft moving family and an Army family that moves in that really didn't have a choice. So thank you. Thank you for that.
But I think that's a great idea, too, and the schools should see the benefits of that, I would hope, and then they would apply it to the Microsoft families as
well. Yes, sir.
Chairman, Mr. Sanchez, you mentioned something about non-custodial parents. And in what context did you mean that?
In the context of powers of attorney and recognizing, as the chair just mentioned, if a single parent, that single parent deploys, leaves a power of attorney with an uncle in another town, another school district, there are different interpretations as to what happens with that parent with the power of attorney as to what rights they have to make decisions for that child's education. That's generally what the area is addressing.
So, Mr. Sanchez and Mr. Chair, how would that relate to the matter that's before, say, the court, when the court order has been different? So you have, we've had this problem in Oregon, I think General Caldwell can probably, he's talked about in the past, where someone has left to go be deployed, they have custody of their child, the custody goes to a non-custodial parent, and then when they come back, they don't want to give up custody. Would that impact that?
I think that that's, when we get down to that granularity, it would end up being the way the rules are written within the commission. I think the general guidelines are more focused on the ability to have the child continue to go to school in that other school district, and I can't really answer that, your question.
So my assumption is, Mr. Chair, since it would go more to the issue of school than who has legal custody.
Yes,
sir. Would
that
be correct?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Chairman of the committee, if I could add something, I've dealt with several interstate compacts, two of them. You probably remember both of them.
Yes.
One, the adult compact, and the other, the juvenile compact. Now, to facilitate this process, I did ask Legislative Council's office to start the drafting process. But what I did is I took it not off of the compact here, the model I have here, but the adult compact, and asked them to combine it with the first 15 pages, which are basically the operative provisions, because there are constitutional issues involved that we have to straighten out with the compact. What I'd also like to let you know is that an interstate compact, Council State Government's been actively involved. They, in Lexington, Kentucky, is where they administer these programs. And in any interstate compact that you enter into, the body that administers the compact, to a certain extent, can supersede state law. So you would be delegating to that interstate body the ability to impact students in Oregon. Just want to let you know that. But the draft has started. It's based on the Oregon model because of constitutional concerns, for example, of delegating to a non-state entity in measures that could impact our budget. You know, you're required to pass a budget in a two-year period. You can't make that contingent upon an action of some outside body.
And Mr. Taylor, as you pointed that out, that is a concern that we are looking at and are attempting to address on the task force in Washington.
Okay. Great.
Thank you very much.
The next item on the agenda is a work session.
We have Cindy Hunt from the Department of Justice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Cindy Hunt, yeah. We got this request, and I talked to you. I asked Cindy Hunt, who used to be with Legislative Council's office, is now in the Department of Education, to discuss how this matter is handled currently.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hi. Mr. Taylor mentioned, I'm Cindy Hunt. I'm the Legal Affairs Coordinator from the Department of Education now, and I brought my buddy Morgan Allen from the Department of Ed, too, to back me up here. Bill asked me to speak to you today about how Oregon is addressing the issues that were raised by the Interstate Compact that you just heard about. And as part of that, I asked our agency if we have received any complaints from any children of military families or any questions just generally. And they said no. In the last 7 years, we've received nothing. No complaints, no questions, nothing like that. And in the agency, we do have an individual who's specifically assigned to veterans matters and military matters and assigned to backing up the families of the military. And as part of her duties, in fact, the superintendent of public instruction, when a military person returns to Oregon, we write a welcome home letter that specifies these are the benefits that you can receive in Oregon as far as education benefits. And many of those are under the GI Bill. So the ones that I'm going to focus on today, though, are the K-12 benefits. So if a child is 18 and still going to high school, they can receive benefits under the GI Bill. And our person does work with them to make that happen and also works with the district to make that happen. So when I took a look at the compact, I think all of the issues that were raised by the compact are either addressed in federal law, state law, or local policies. And so today I'm going to highlight a couple of these, and I want to emphasize this is not a full analysis of the compact, because I think what the prior speaker said was it was taking Washington at least 5 months and counting to do that. But that's an example of how complex some of these laws are, especially some of the federal laws around special ed and also the Federal Educational Rights Protection Act. And so one of the issues with the compact is it adds another level of complexity onto these laws. I want you to keep that in mind as I'm explaining these. So the first issue that the compact raises is on eligibility of children to attend school. In Oregon, if you're a child between the ages of 5 and 19 and your parent's legal guardian or person in parental relationship resides in the school district, you get a free education. If you show up at the doorstep of the school, they let you in. Now, one of the interesting things about the compact in this area is it's actually more restrictive than Oregon law. Because the compact, to be a legal guardian, requires a power of attorney, whereas under Oregon law, if you're a person in parental relationship, which does not require a power of attorney, that counts as residency for the child. So let me give you an example. So if a child of a military family, if their single parent goes off to serve, that child can then stay with a family friend or a relative, and it doesn't require a power of attorney. That child can then attend school where that family friend or relative lives. Because in Oregon, I mean, our law is around setting a priority towards giving children an education and not worrying about what kind of legal documents that they have. I mean, that's essentially it. So that was one issue I saw in it that kind of concerned us, that that it was more restrictive. Also in Oregon, it raises issues of like extracurricular activities and children being able to be accepted into sports. So right now, that's also governed by school district policy and organizations like the OSAA. But we do have a specific law that prohibits the school district from denying participation just because the student transferred in. Also under those laws and policies, there's lots of appeal rights for students. Under the OSAA's policies, there's at least two levels, and then eventually it can come to the Department of Education. And the compact also mentioned issues around graduation and the placement of students in school. So with those issues, all of the school districts are required to have policies in place. This is something that they need to deal with on a daily basis because of our mobile student population generally. And so what these policies do is they allow for students to receive credit based on assessments that they might take, based on showing a mastery of the subject. But the other thing that happens in Oregon, which is interesting, is that at least 90% of our school districts have regional accreditation that's outside of the state. And as part of that, if there's another school from outside the state, whether it's private, public, whatever, if they also have regional accreditation, they have to accept those credits in. And that would also include, for example, Department of Defense schools, anything like that. And so I think that's one of the reasons we haven't gotten questions about this, is because in this area, the kinds of questions we get are around homeschooled kids or from schools that maybe the school district doesn't view as a credible school. So the other thing that we're working on as part of the new Oregon diploma requirements is, because we have such a mobile student population, is allowing those students to transfer in and out. So that does involve credit for proficiency. That's a word you're going to hear about maybe next session, which is around giving credit for students' life experiences, courses, also a variety of assessment options. Some of the assessment options that would apply to some of these kids are, in order to get an Oregon diploma, you have to meet or exceed standards on the Oregon assessment, but we're also going to be setting a standard based on the SAT, the ACT, and those are kinds of tests that are available to students across the country. Another area that the compact touched on and gave some examples of issues around was special education. Special education is heavily dictated by federal law. The rights that students are given are clearly specified under the federal law. So what happens under special education, if a child's receiving special ed and they transfer into the district, they continue receiving the same services that they received where they were from until an evaluation's done, and then the school district drafts up a new individual education plan for the student. So again, under special ed, the idea is that you look at the individual student and you continue giving services to that student. And so there isn't a break in services. Another area was around the transfer of records, and this also is under federal law, but also Oregon has expanded upon this a bit. So in Oregon, if a school district receives a student within 10 days, they notify the other district, the sending district, then that sending district has 10 days to send the records. So within 20 days, you're getting the records. Part of the issue around the transfer of records is that, like I said, it's heavily regulated by federal law, and many of these records are highly confidential. A student or a school district can only release these records to, you know, upon permission from a parent or to a very specific list of individuals. Like, for example, at the department, when we get student records, we don't get a specific name with them. We get a secure student ID. And so that's just an example. It's really to protect, you know, the privacy of these students and to make it a lot harder for someone with ill intent to be able to use these records, you know, against the student or to create harm. So finally, I was glad to hear Mr. Taylor. Wake up, Bill.
I'm listening. I got my head down to listen so I can hear you better, Cindy.
To talk about how the compact may violate the Oregon Constitution, so I put on my old LC hat a little bit here. And I saw two specific areas which I've highlighted for you in the written materials that I thought were problematic under the Oregon Constitution. So the first one was the separation of powers issue, because it creates or directs the states that enter into the compact to create a committee. And on that committee, it specifies there should be legislative members and executive branch members. So that's a separation of powers kind of an issue. The way we get around that in Oregon a lot is the legislative members are advisory, but the compact doesn't necessarily allow for that. And then the second issue was the delegation of powers issues, basically delegating your authority to do laws to this outside entity. And so I would suggest that you ask legislative counsel for an opinion and also options to try to address these two constitutional issues if you decide to pursue that.
Mr. Members of the committee, as it relates to separation of powers and the adult compact, both these issues came up in the adult compact, and we took care of that issue by making the committee advisory. Mm-hmm. So it did not, all it could do was give advice. Advice did not necessarily have to be followed. As it relates to delegation of powers, there's a provision in the U.S. Constitution that does allow for interstate compacts.
And if it, in fact, it falls within that provision, the state can delegate. The other thing is the state can do, it can enter into a contract as it relates to those matters. I guess more so than a legal issue is always a policy question of whether you want to be delegating to another group the right to make regulations that will bind the state.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. Then, Bill, that leads me to a question. If we enter into a contract or if we delegate, at the bottom of that agreement, does it say we can get out of it within 30 days? If for some reason, do you see where I'm going with all this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, these compacts do have a provision that would allow you to withdraw from it the same way that you negate a statute. You simply repeal it.
Right. I just want to follow up. Not that we'd ever do that, but just to, you know, for my own peace of mind, that we, you know, we aren't being railroaded or told what to do or giving up our ability to make laws and giving it to somebody we don't even know. Because I can imagine the politics of that could get rather ugly, if nothing else. But I'm sure that would never happen.
Well, thank you for bringing and pointing out these.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I want to emphasize is, like I said, it's a very complex area, and it's adding complexity to it. So I know that when I looked at it, I had concerns about how our 197 school districts, you know, would administer it. So I think that's something to consider if you move forward with this is, you know, is that I think the prior speaker alluded to, you know, the fiscal impact on the state, but I think something else to consider is the fiscal impact on all of those school districts, too.
Okay, thank you very much. Is anybody else testify on that? Thank you. So we're going to go into a work session and an introduction of legislative concepts, and I'll have Mr. Taylor go through those. And this doesn't mean that the committee approves these or is recommending them, but just what we're doing is getting them into the LC, getting them drafted now so that we can be ready to go when the session starts next year, and we'll have them up and running. And at that time, there'll be full debate and full hearings on most of them anyway. Mr. Cato.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have both your agenda and my handout, which I've made a couple of typos on there. I can start off with LC-125, allows a former prisoner of war Gold Star family member, a person awarded Purple Heart, a person awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor to register a car and pay a fee of under $15, basically a vehicle under 10,000 pounds. That's LC-125.
And we mentioned earlier that the 10,000 pounds is where you go up to a truck. So you can register a car, but we don't want somebody, you know, getting a commercial freight line or something.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, have LC-126, which creates the Oregon Veterans Business Enterprise Program to assist Oregon veterans in starting a new business, appropriates, that's $250,000, not $25,000. And that was based on the bill last year, House Bill 3160. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LC-127 allows the Director of the Veterans Affairs to establish two additional Oregon Veterans Homes if the Director determines that the two facilities currently authorized, one is in operation, the others being built, are insufficient. I understand that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is a significant part of the fund, so that comes from the federal government. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have LC-128, which is very similar to LC-1538. Both create a Veterans Merit Program, a scholarship program. The difference between the two drafts is that the latter one has a requirement that you are not receiving federal educational benefits, so it would solely be a state benefit. The 128 has no such limitation. They both have nice relating clauses to them.
And on that, I know in the past, early in the Vietnam era, before there was a federal GI Bill, people coming back got $50 a month, I think, at the time, but then once they started driving their federal benefit, the state discontinued that. So.
Correct, Mr. Chair. LC-129, Mr. Chair, appropriates $300,000 for maintenance of the Oregon Veterans Home.
Okay, now, I had a question.
Yes, you did. The number of $420,000, but the draft says $300,000, but if that can easily be changed, if the committee intends to.
Okay, it was my understanding when I was up there that they were talking about around $400,000 for the needed maintenance. That building is about 10 years old now, coming upon the time when it's going to need. So,
it needs 400?
Yeah, 400, I think 20 is what the number. So
okay,
we might want to amend that and get that in at that higher number.
So you prefer that it say, on line 7, it say $420,000 rather than
$300,000.
Okay. Chairman, the committee, LC-130 increases the amount of property exempted from property tax from $18,000 to $25,000 for veterans with a disability of 40% or more.
Okay, and they had a number there earlier that they said that was supposed to have been $30,000.
Okay, so it says 25, but it can easily be changed.
Okay.
Okay. LC-131, Chair members of the committee, includes a disabled veteran with the definition of persons with a disability for the purposes of the homestead property tax deferral. Chair members of the committee, LC-132 limits the $60,000 property tax exemption to those killed in action rather than those who have died while in service, permits retroactive claim for military homestead property tax exemption for the tax years beginning on July 1, 2005 and July 1, 2006 for 180 days after the effective date of this act or 30 days after the person's return from service. Chairman of the committee, this is similar to the bill that was filed last session.
Get a question. Is it killed in action versus died, so it's revenue neutral? Is that why they're doing that?
Chair, members of the committee, I don't know. One of the questions I had is what's the definition of killed in action? I could not find that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it cuts in half. Half people die, half people get killed in action. And depending on who wants to do the paperwork at the other end, it depends on whether they got killed in action or whether they died. So.
In their rank.
The person writing the report.
If you're in a car accident in the convoy, are you killed in action?
No, you're not. You died.
You died.
Right, because that's why happens. Because you only half the people are killed in action, half the people died. Just okay. Historically in conflict.
Okay.
That's why I was asking whether it was a revenue neutral.
We'll go ahead and move it forward as is, and we'll sure take a look at that.
I was just curious why it was written that way.
Thank you.
Chair members of the committee, LC-133 eliminates hunting and fishing license fees for war veterans who are residents of Oregon and have at least a 10% disabled rather than the current 25%. That comes from a bill, similar bill last session, House Bill 2547. As Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LC-134 requires a school district to provide students with the opportunity to salute the United States flag at least once every school day rather than the current once a week.
Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, LC-135 directs the Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs to assist veterans of military service in obtaining screening tests and treatment for exposure to depleted uranium. Creates a task force on exposure to depleted uranium. Chair, members of the committee, LC-136 allows employees a credit against income tax for amounts paid as compensation to employees on active duty if the employee is a member of the military reserve of the Oregon National Guard, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009.
And that is for someone who continues to pay the member while they're on active duty?
I believe, yes. Yeah. And that's similar to the House Bill 3158 last year that I believe the Biden committee after passing out of the House. LC-137 proposes amendment to the Oregon Constitution that would dedicate a portion of the net proceeds from the state lottery to services for Oregon veterans. Chairman of the committee, the next bill would be LC-264, provides a $1,000 credit against income tax for provisions of pro bono legal services of at least 12 hours to a member of the National Guard or the military reserve of the United States. That was filed on behalf of Belda Rogers, an attorney in Salem. LC 1535 encourages the City of Portland and the Port of Portland to locate the USS Ranger in Portland area and to enter a lease with the USS Ranger Foundation Museum to operate the Ranger. LC 1538 creates a Veterans Merit Scholarship Program, the difference between that and the earlier bill, and I think I skipped over LC 1540, expands post-secondary institution waiver for children, spouses, and unmarried surviving spouses and deceased or disabled veterans to include Oregon's community colleges. As chairman of the committee, this also removes the provision as it applied after September 1, 2001.
Yeah, thank you.
That's been removed simply by taking the phrase out. LC 141 increases the tax credit from $1,000 to $5,000 for the health care providers who contract to provide health care services under the TRIPAC military health care system, and the provider provides services to at least 10 patients each year. As chairman of the committee, I've already mentioned LC 1538. And then finally, LC 1539 allows a person who served in the Merchant Marine Services during World War II, the Korean conflict, or the Vietnam War to apply for special motor vehicle registration.
Mr. Chairman, question. I was at VFW Lodge 1442 on Southeast 87th and Powell, just north of Powell. And good people there asked me about hiring preferences. Is there a draft out there relating to the preference hiring of veterans? Because if there isn't, I'm going to submit a bill for it, and I've got the exact language these gentlemen wanted, but I want to make sure that I don't forget to do it, and I want to make sure it's on our mind. And there's some federal law put in place years ago. They told me that Oregon isn't up to speed on it. Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. If they were referring to preference points, which is the only thing I can think of, the legislature last year passed a bill that completely covered that issue and brought it into concurrence with the 1944 law that has been there for a very long time.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah.
Now you're triggering my memory. Thank you. Their major concern was that we aren't implementing it fast enough, and they're not happy with it. Maybe I should just talk about this after the committee and go return back on and follow up on that, because I clearly remember them talking to me about
I think
that.
I have an answer for you, and we can just close it out now as far as I'm
concerned. Yeah, please, go ahead.
All right, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler. The last piece of business to be done there was the Boley administrative rule, because Boley has the responsibility for investigating any alleged violations of the preference points within not only the state of Oregon employers, but any public employer in the state. That rule is out now. It's completed. I've read it.
Okay.
And I can't see anything about it that doesn't cover everything that the bill intended.
Right.
So I think that was the last piece that needed to be done. I know the issue of timeliness came up because I saw a document that was sent to the head of Boley and from a veteran that wasn't happy with the length of time that it took. But bottom line is, it's done.
All right, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll just ask them give me that information, I can forward it to them.
Absolutely.
Maybe that'll answer their concerns.
I'll be happy to do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Copy me, too.
And a copy for
send that same complaint from Independence.
Okay. Well, there we go. Okay.
Thank you.
You post there. I'll give it to Bill.
There you go.
That's right. All right. Thank you.
Can you email it?
These are not in any priority order. The bills we just went through, so it's not like, because the first one talks about the Gold Star family, the education somewhere else down the road. So these are all going to be introduced. We'll get them out and then get them set up for the hearings next session.
You want a motion, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And Bill, should I read down the list?
We just moved to move them up there.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move the bills that have been explained to us by Mr. Taylor be made into committee bills for the 09-11 session.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, second by about 2 feet.
Double seconds.
Yeah, double second.
Third.
Third is voting.
Yeah, Senate is voting, that's right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Oppose? Hearing none. So, and I did say work session when we started this, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. With that, is there anybody else who'd like to testify on these today? Thank you. Okay. That being the case, I'll close the work session on the bills, legislative concepts, and with any further business before the committee today. With no further business, I'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you all for attending. I appreciate it.